This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who desire to be. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about increasing your income, your productivity, and just generally having a better life while serving your clients better with America's most historically proven asset class, income property. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds. Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome Matt Jones. He's a guest coming to us from Down Under, and he has got a fascinating story. He's the founder of Property Resource Shop, but the way he got there will amaze you. He started out as a postie. and for those of you who aren't Down Under, that's a postal worker. And then he became a property investor. It's a great story. Matt, welcome. How you doing?
Very well, Jason. Thanks very much for having me, mate.
Good, good. I have to say, I've been to Australia, New Zealand. I've been Down Under, but I never heard postie before. I like that. That's good.
Very, very common term here, yeah.
Yeah, good stuff, good stuff. So how did you start? What happened? You were out delivering mail and decided maybe you should own some of these properties, or how did it all come about?
Yeah, I kind of took on the postie role as like a transitional job. I was actually in a career in theatre. I was a lighting technician for 15 years, and I just got a little bit fed up with where it was all going. And I read a property book, and I remember sitting on the plane, you know, reading the book, read it from cover to cover, and it just clicked for me. So I ended up quitting that job and then becoming a postie, and that really freed up my headspace to learn how to do property investing. But it also meant I was, you know, riding around town looking at, you know, a couple of thousand properties a day, you know, delivering mail. And that really opened my eyes to what was available out there and what I could do. So that was, you know, that was really the start of getting into property investing for me.
So when you were looking at property, I mean, you know, all of us, even if we're not investors, we're always driving by properties. That's, you know, they're everywhere. Under all is land. So what intrigued you about it, though? I mean, what were you looking for? Were you looking for specific properties in which to invest? Were you looking for overgrown grass, deferred maintenance, you know, people that look like they abandoned their properties?
Well, I really just kind of everywhere I went, wherever I saw a for sale sign, I'd just sort of ask a question, you know, if there was a builder at the back building a deck, or if they were laying a concrete driveway, or if there was an agent there. I just try and immerse myself in the industry just so I could learn. You know, I was very green back then. I didn't really know how to make it work. And for me, it was just about finding another way to replace my income at the time. So I hadn't really been exposed to other forms of leverage or investing, and I just knew there had to be another way, and property really resonated with me. So riding around on the postie bike, it kind of exposed me to that. And then I started doing some renovations to begin with. And
hang on, don't go any further. The postie what?
The postie what?
Yeah, you said the postie. Did you say truck? I don't think you said truck. What was that word? We going to catch some of these cool words here.
I can't remember what I said, actually. Postie.
Well, you said you were riding around in the postie something. What's it called?
Postie bike.
Postie bike. Oh, okay. You were riding a bike. Okay, so
it's a motorbike, little CT110. So
Oh, okay. Yeah, they don't do that in the U.S. I don't think. I've never seen it. So okay, good. Just had to clarify.
Yeah, you got to deliver about 2,500 houses a day, so you got to get around pretty quick. It's a very demanding job, as I found out physically. I got used to it after a while, but yeah, it was very easy. You know, it wasn't hard to sit on a bike and deliver mail. It allowed me to sort of focus on how was I going to make this work? You know, how was I going to be a property investor and replace my income and look for other ways to create some income?
Okay. All right. So what happened next?
So I bought a property, and it was just a rundown sort of post-war deceased estate sort of property, and I got in there and renovated it myself, which was nuts at the time. Very much trying to do everything, you know, I was building decks and re-roofing and installing toilets and all that sort of stuff. So it was hard work, and I kind of learnt a lot doing that, made a little bit of money, nothing to write home about, but it sort of exposed me to, okay, if I did a couple of these a year, that kind of starts to replace the income that I had. And then I just kind of grew into different, more advanced strategies like subdivision and development. So it kind of, the postie work really just gave me the space to sort of learn, you know, without being consumed by, you know, the 9 to 5, you know, the stress of the 9 to 5. It was just allowing me to give me that headspace.
Sure, sure. Makes a lot of sense. So was your first deal a property that you found on your postal route?
Yeah, it was actually. Yeah, I'd started to get to know the agents, so they knew me in the area, and I'd finish my job around sort of 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So I'd go home, have some lunch, and then just start ringing the agents, you know, looking at deals, crunching the numbers, and they kind of got to know me, which was a key part of, I think, becoming a good property investor, is just building those relationships in the early days. And that's what I was able to do because I was on the road.
Having a network, having a team. Yeah, very good point. Okay.
You know, looked at probably 50, 60, 70 properties, I suppose, crunched the numbers on all of those, and finally come up with something that that I could get my head around. You know, that was fairly simple. I could get in at a low price and add some value, put it back on the market, and make some profit, and then move on to the next one.
Okay, so you did that first one yourself, and did you buy it directly from the owner? Did you have an agent? I just want to make sure the listeners know how the start happened.
Yeah, I went through an agent for the first time, and a lot of our stuff we do now, you know, we still go through agents. I think it's the best way to you know, just forming those relationships and having those deals come to you. So that's kind of how that first one started. But I realized, you know, after that renovation was not my bag. It wasn't my skill set, I suppose. These days I'd much rather employ a builder to do all the work rather than do it myself. But it leveraged me into more advanced strategies like subdivision, and that's kind of where things really took off for me, I suppose, where I could, you know, manage two or three deals at once, and there was a lot more opportunity to profit, lot less time intensive than a renovation, and that's when things, you know, really I started to realize, okay, I can do this full time now. You know, I can drop the postie work, and I can just do more of these deals.
Yeah, yeah, good stuff. So basically, you got into the business of flipping houses.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, we were very much, I was taking a wage out of that and just, yeah, flipping them and putting the profits into the next deal, taking a little bit of cash to live off. And that kind of just allowed us to build a capital base to be able to get into bigger deals. So, yeah, it was very much flipping them in the beginning.
And now are you a buy and hold investor?
Bit of both, really. We reside in France now. So we took a year off to come and live in France for a while with the family. And that means I'm a lot more passive now. I have to be. So we do a lot of joint ventures where there's we've got some very good colleagues back home that do sort of small to medium development boutique sort of townhouses where we put cash into or we provide servicing for. So that allows us to continue you know, building our portfolio while we're not actually there. And then when we get back, you know, we'll get a bit more active again, and I'll start doing the subdivisions again, no doubt. But at the moment, it's just more about creating a bit of balance in our life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. How do you like living in France? Are you in Paris?
No, we're a few hours south of there. So we're in a beautiful part of the world, the Loire Valley region. And yeah, we've managed to immerse ourselves in the community here, and still struggling a bit with the language, but that's getting there. The kids are in school. So yeah, it's been very much just an amazing cultural experience for us, and seeing it through the kids' eyes has just been really rewarding. So we're very grateful that we've been able to do that.
I think I have to ask you, you know, I've been talking with some of my friends in Europe about the terrorist attacks and, you know, these radical Muslim extremists. What's the vibe over there? What's the feeling? Does that concern you at all? I mean, you're not in the city, so it's probably, you know, be such a remote chance it would ever affect you. But
I mean, we feel pretty safe where we are because it's a smaller town, but it's very solemn. You know, it has affected people, obviously, and it's very sad with what's happened. But, you know, I tend to just try not to buy into it too much, because then they're kind of winning when that happens. So I try to continue day to day as I would normally. However, we do, you know, you are on alert a little bit, particularly when you're going to be traveling somewhere. People coming to see us that are coming through Paris, you're a little bit wary. So, yeah, it does put an edge on things, but you try and get past that as much as you can.
Yeah, good stuff. Have you looked at properties in France, just out of curiosity? You know, you talked about being a remote investor. I don't know, do you have to be a remote investor?
Well, that's how I'm sort of structuring myself now, so that I can do more of this with the family. We want to go back home. Obviously, we love it there, but it's nice to be able to step out of it every now and then. So hopefully we can continue doing that. But yeah, it's been hard not to look at property here, because it's just so cheap, you know, and it's a very different mentality here, because people don't move houses very often. You know, when we first arrived, we tried to find a long-term rental, and it was very difficult. You know, back home, as I'm sure it isn't where you are, it's just you go into an agency and you ask for a rental, a price range, an area that you want to live in, and there's probably 10 to choose from. Whereas here it was no one moves house. You know, the houses get passed down through the generation. So any rentals that were available, you know, they were missing kitchens and you know, strange things like that. It was just a totally different standard to get used to. But it's tempting to buy into it, but I'm very wary because it's still very new here, so I'm still educating myself. But maybe in the next 6 to 12 months, I'll look at getting into the market a bit. But I always like to take my time to make sure I understand the market and know the area really well. But there's some great shadows going cheap here, that's for sure.
Yeah. So just clarify your location. Where were you investing in real estate? Where were you a postal worker? You were in Australia, and were you up in the Queensland area? Whereabouts?
Yeah, that's right. In Brisbane, so the capital city of Queensland.
Right. Been there? Yeah.
Yeah, great. We actually live on the Sunshine Coast, so that's about an hour north of Brisbane, just more for lifestyle.
And like what's the price for a single family home there?
Median price is around $500,000 in Brisbane. It goes...
Oh, man, that's not going to work. And let me guess, that will rent for $2,500 to $3,000 per month.
No, not quite.
No? Tell me how much.
Probably about...
Tell me.
Probably about $2,000 a month.
That's terrible.
Months.
Whoa. Yeah, that's awful.
Not great returns there. It's long-term stuff is not great. I mean, we tend to focus on, you know, being able to manufacture the profit ourselves through you know, active sort of strategies. But it's actually in a bit of a boom at the moment. You know, Brisbane, it's a very hot market. People are paying over what they should, you know, at the moment. But like anything, you know, it swings and roundabouts. We'll get that cycle. It'll come up and down. It's probably a good time to step back for 6 months, I think, and just watch it happen and then wait for it to cool off a bit.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. And when you say they're so cheap in France, how much are they there? How much are single family homes there that you'd be interested in?
Yeah, we can get it. It depends where it is, obviously, but I've seen property as cheap as 50,000 euros for like a 3-bedroom house. And then going up to around 300,000 euros for something a bit more better quality in a better location, but not much over that. I've seen sort of 20.
And give us the rent comparison. How much does that property rent for?
Probably around about 1,000 euros a month.
This is the $50,000 property or 50,000 euro property?
No, probably for $250,000, $300,000 property, 1,000 a month.
That's terrible.
Yeah, there's nothing in it. Yeah. And there's no incentive whatsoever to buy an investment property here. You know, you actually get penalized for it.
Tell us about that. What happens there?
I'm still trying to understand it myself, but from what I can see, they slap a capital gains tax on there but before you've made the capital gain, you know, before you go and sell it. So
unbelievable.
Yeah, in Australia, you know, when you go and sell it, you'd pay a certain amount of tax based on the gain if it's an investment property. But here... Okay, you announce that you're going to rent that property. Immediately there's it could be $40,000 or $50,000 cost just to go and just because you've decided to rent it and create an income from it.
Unbelievable. So let me guess. That's why there's no rentals and the supply is terrible because the socialist government just penalizes anything anybody wants to do that's good.
That's right. Yeah. It's all about being really comfortable here. I think that's how they like to keep it, and they do. They do focus on the lifestyle here, and it is a good lifestyle, but there's no sort of entrepreneurial spirit.
There's no vibrancy. Yeah, there's no vibrancy to that market. And that's how Europe is in general. It's just stagnant. I mean, in Germany, where I was born, you know, there's just tons of rent control. People just, God, it's just government just interferes with everything. It's terrible. It really is.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's a cultural thing, too, because no one seems to be, you know, uprising against it. And they are a pretty
vocal country. No one cares.
Yeah, they're happy just to go with the status quo. So if you want to do something different, you kind of got to move somewhere else, really.
They probably look down on you if you try to do anything out of the box over there. The tall puppy syndrome, right?
Yeah. We kind of just got to laugh at it because we're here for a cultural experience, and that's what we're doing. When you get into the paperwork and the logistics and the things that they like to complicate things here, so. We kind of just sort of turn a blind eye and just enjoy the wine and cheese that they provide.
Makes sense to me. Good. You have something you talk about, the 2-minute deal analyzer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a formula I created a while ago. It's just something that I've always used and still use today. It's just a 2-minute deal assessment formula that I kind of put together so that I can look at deals quickly. You know, you can sort through 10 deals really quickly and work out which one you want to focus on the most. And I find a lot of people come up and ask me about crunching the numbers, and they struggle with it. And you know, I ask them, how many numbers have you crunched? You know, how many deals have you looked at? And it's often 5, 10, 20. And really, as you know, you've got to look at hundreds, you know, to find a decent one. So you need a good formula to sort of sift through them.
And I just want to clarify, you need to do that if you're doing it yourself, if you're out there actively doing it.
That's
but
right.
Yeah, got it. Okay. So how do you assess a deal in 2 minutes, though? What do you do?
It's very much a cash in, cash out sort of thing. So I always look at it from a point of view where I'm going to get in, make the profit and move on. That way, that's the worst case scenario. Whereas if I'm going to hold it long term, you know, the market might go up, but I generally don't sort of bank on that. And it's very much just putting expenses in one column, income in the other column, and coming up with a profit on cost percentage that gives me an idea of whether I want to move forward to a more detailed feasibility. So after a while, you can kind of do it in your head. Once you know the numbers, the expenses, what sort of you know, active strategy you're going to apply, you can do it really quickly. So it's just something that I've used and put together myself, and it seems to work really well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, can you take us through that a little bit, like the cash in? Give us an example, if you would. Is it possible to do that really quickly?
Yeah. So say you had a $500,000 house, you know, in Brisbane. You were looking to do a quick subdivision, so say split it into two and sell off both blocks. So I would just put down the purchase price, the closing costs, so that the stamp duties and that sort of thing, which is generally about 5% of the purchase costs in Brisbane. I'd put down, you know, any demolition costs, subdivision costs, renovation costs, selling costs, and just add it all up. And that might come to $800,000 maybe on a $500,000 house, depending on what council you're in, sort of what suburb what sort of subdivision you're doing, and then work out the end sales value from those two lots that you're selling. So say you're keeping the house on one of the lots, it might still be worth $500,000 with the house on it, even though you've chopped down the land. And then the vacant lot that you've created out of the subdivision might be worth $300,000-$400,000. So that might give you, say, $50,000-$100,000 profit, just on rough numbers. So expenses $800, income $900. And maybe minus some tax. I mean, it's all gross sort of numbers. And that sort of gives you a quick heads up on what sort of profit you're going to make. And then I'll just work out a profit on cost expense. So total profit divided by total expenses times 100. If it's more than 10%, I'll go, okay, great. Let's go to the next level. Let's start crunching the numbers a little bit deeper.
Right. And so you're doing something very active. I mean, you're subdividing the property and selling off a lot, or maybe more than one lot even, right?
Yeah. It's very much infill sort of investing, where it's established housing there. So it's trying to find something that has a large backyard or maybe a corner block. And then utilizing that land, because there's a lot of demand for more housing in those areas. So it's the council looks favorably on you doing that. And then you're providing extracting, I guess, another block of land that wasn't there before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. Okay, good, good, good to know. Those are definitely more expensive properties, so they're not as much designed to buy and hold as they are to flip, right?
It can kind of do both. You know, I tend to work the numbers on being able to flip it because I want to know, you know, the exit strategy early on and how I'm going to get out of the deal. But often we've kept it, so we might sell the vacant lot and then pay down the loan on the front house, which creates a positively geared investment. And if it's in a good capital growth area that we like, then we'll tend to hold that property rather than flip it. So it comes down to, you know, the location, the type of house that's there, the demand for it, what sort of rental we can get on it. But if we can pay that debt down by selling the vacant block of land, then that creates a nice little investment.
Talk to us about how your debt works in Australia. I mean, you don't have the 30-year fixed rate mortgages like we do here in the States, do you?
No, it's generally P&I, principal and interest, or you can get interest-only loans, but it's still the same sort of term, 30 years. Depending on the credit market at the time, the LVRs are around, you know, 80% before you start paying mortgage insurance.
We call it LTV, loan to improvement, or loan to value ratio.
That's right. Yeah, loan to value ratio. Yep. So anything greater than 80%, you'll start paying insurance fees on top of that. But there are some second and third tier lenders that are offering, you know, a better LVR than that. So you can get in for as little as 5 or 10% deposit with the bank covering.
But is your rate actually fixed for 3 decades, for 30 years, or does it become adjustable after 5, 10 years?
No, it's usually, I think you can get fixed up to about 8 or 9 years.
Right, so it's not a 30-year fixed. I just want to clarify that. I didn't think it was, yeah.
No, it's variable generally for that long, but you can lock in a good rate for a while if that's what suits at the time.
So give us an example. I mean, right now in the U.S. on an investment property, you know, I'm not looking at a rate sheet. This is just off the top of my head. But, you know, say you're going to pay maybe 4.5%. What kind of rate are you going to pay in an Australian property?
So 4.5% interest rate?
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Interest rates at the moment in Australia are similar. It's gone around 5%. So very similar. Yeah. It's.
So 5%, and the longest it's going to be fixed is for 8 years, right?
Yeah. People are fixing for more like 3 or 4, though. 8 years is pretty extreme.
Okay. So it becomes an adjustable rate after that?
Yeah, you can choose at the time. So there's a lot of different loan products out there on how you want to go with it, but it's... interest rates are quite low at the moment, so people are starting to fix for a bit longer, so 3, 4, 5 years, if they can get a good rate, with the expectation that it might go up. So yeah, it's very much horses for courses. But I think people like to fix them in here just so they've got that security of mortgage repayments and knowing what that's going to be. But you can kind of play around with it a little bit as well with the different loan products.
Right, right. Okay. Last thing I want to ask you, first of all, give out your website if you would.
Yeah, propertyresourceshop.com.
Property Resource Shop. Okay. What would you say to someone, Matt, who is, you know, just looking to do their first deal, who hasn't done anything yet, who's maybe fearful, they're scared of things going wrong or what might happen? I mean, you took action and that made quite a difference for you, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'd say and I get that question a lot. We run networking groups where I am, and a lot of newbies come through. And the thing I think people miss is getting clear on why they're doing it in the first place. So what are they trying to achieve here? I mean, most of the time it's financial freedom, but drilling down a little bit further than that, what's the emotional reason behind that? And that'll define, you know, what strategy you need to implement to get to that goal, and then that'll define what property you need to buy. But technically, I always like to encourage people just to look at long-term relationships with building a good team around you, you know, having good agents on your team so that the deals are coming to you, and just understanding your area really well, you know, focusing on 2 or 3 suburbs and getting to know them intimately so that you know and you have confidence in a good deal when you see it.
Very good advice. Well, Matt Jones, thank you so much for sharing your story and your wisdom with us. We really appreciate having you on.
My absolute pleasure, Jason. Thanks very much for having me.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and 3 books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.